Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Moran. Counsel for the defense.
Chief Judge Efron, honorable members, may it please the court. Good morning. My name is Captain Anthony Ortiz, and together with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, we represent the appellate in this case, Airman First Class David Moran. In the present case, the issue is whether a series of references to appellant's exercise of his constitutional rights amounted to plain error. We would submit, if taken into account with prosecution's theme and intent, that there is error in this case that requires reversal. In the present case, the prosecution presented a pervasive theme throughout the entire trial, beginning with his opening statement, that appellant was, quote, the jack of all crimes who had done anything. Within the context of trial counsel's argument, in essence, trial counsel was alleging that appellant was a career criminal who hung out with bad people and who was gaming the system. As such, within the opening, trial counsel specifically drew attention to appellant's assertion of his rights at least one time, specifically on page 334. Trial counsel noted, quote, asked him if he would consent to a blood draw because they couldn't do other means because of his injuries at the time. He said yes, transported him to the hospital. Once they got to the hospital, he said, no, I'm not going to give consent. Based on the prosecution's theme, trial counsel focused the member's attention to appellant exercising his rights as substantive evidence of his guilt. It has been established in a long line of cases since the Supreme Court's decision in Griffin v. California and several cases before this honorable court that references to appellant's exercise of his constitutional rights pursuant to the Fourth and Fifth Amendment during argument is impermissible. We would submit that this reasoning does not only relate to argument, but also relates to evidence adduced at trial. In Griffin v. California, the Supreme Court noted that the rationale against references to the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination was because it amounted to the court's solemnization of the accused's silence into evidence. The key word that we would like to focus on is that they placed an evidentiary standard on it. And in this case, we would submit that the same rationale that has been used in the line of cases relating to argument relates to evidence adduced at trial.
Do you have any cases that support that, or are you just making that analogy in this case?
We are just making the analogy. I believe there was some reference in certain cases, such as Gilly, that where evidence was constitutional evidence was adduced during findings rather than just argument.
Well, for instance, in Turner, we said refusal to consent to a search may not be considered as evidence of criminal conduct, but that doesn't seem to appear that it may not be admissible as evidence of something else. And the government here is arguing that it was meant to explain how they got their hands on the evidence.
Certainly, Your Honor. We would submit that based on trial counsel's theme as stated in their opening statement and the focusing on his constitutional rights during his closing, it was the impermissible use of his constitutional, of his exercise as substantive evidence of his guilt. Generally, the presidents have been focusing on the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, but we would submit that this also applies to rights asserted under the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. We submit that this has been supported in certain cases, such as Johnson, where this court specifically referenced the Fifth and Sixth Amendment in footnote 1, and also in United States v. Clifton, where trial counsel repeated several references to appellant's assertion of rights, including the right to counsel. As this court noted in Clifton, an appellant may seek representation of counsel without fear of retribution. The manner in which trial counsel elicited this evidence during findings can only lead to one conclusion, that they were attempting to elicit evidence that appellant asserted his rights. In the testimony of Officer Foray, trial counsel first asked him, quote, okay, was there a period of days between when he was actually, when he came to see you, and when you were actually able to make, to attempt to make a collection? The witness did not understand it, and it was rephrased to, were you able to get the collection when you wanted to? I guess is the question. And based on the question, based on the wording of his questions, the only conclusion is that he was attempting to elicit that appellant had refused to consent to a hair sample in the initial interview on 21 March 2002. And we would submit that this is impermissible use of this evidence.
Counsel, in this case, the prosecution introduced evidence that the accused, now the appellant, shaved himself in order, and the implication that the prosecution sought to draw from that was guilty knowledge of drug use. And to what extent do any of the issues that you've raised involve matters that are not pertinent to that particular evidence that was introduced?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That was the prosecution's, one of the prosecution's theory in this case was that he shaved himself in order to avoid detection of drug use.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the defense did not object to that.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the defense is not challenging the admissibility of that evidence here on appeal.
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So what evidence was introduced at trial that you're now complaining of that was not pertinent to the question of or to the circumstances involving shaving himself to avoid detection of drug use?
We would submit that the evidence was pertinent, however, that it required some sort of, I suppose, for lack of a better term, fix. For example, a curative instruction by the military judge.
Okay. Did the defense request a curative instruction?
No, Your Honor.
And under what precedent would a curative instruction be required?
Your Honor, we feel that it amounts to plain error that the military judge should have recognized that this was a focus or a distinct danger was that the members would focus on his assertion of his constitutional rights as substantive evidence, and thus should at a minimum have instructed, given a curative instruction to help offset the danger of this evidence.
Well, under what circumstance would we find plain error without having a precedent that should have alerted the judge that error was occurring in the case?
Certainly. Your Honor, we would probably, we would just reference it by analogy. In many of the cases where constitutional rights were mentioned, a curative instruction was given to offset the danger that resulted from mentioning constitutional rights. While it is not explicitly stated in case law, the military judge does have a sua sponte duty to instruct on certain matters. And we would assert in this case, the military judge had a sua sponte duty to at least at a minimum instruct the members, given the nature of the references. And given the theme of trial counsel's argument, both opening and closing.
If the judge had given such an instruction, would it have been permissible for the trial counsel to make the arguments that he made in the context of that instruction?
We do not feel that he could have in with just an instruction, Your Honor. Again, we would submit that the trial counsel used this as substantive evidence. In fact, he quoted that the most damning evidence was him failing to consent and seeing his attorney. And despite a curative instruction, this is highly prejudicial, impermissible argument.
Where expressly were those words used?
Your Honor, that was used on page 880. The quote is, "Now these drug charges, but probably certainly close to some of the most damning evidence that you have in this courtroom today, is the fact that on March 20th, he is called in an investigation. The 21st, actually, the OSI says, we would like to take your hair. He says, no, thank you. I want to speak to my attorney first."
Well, is that in that paragraph, is the trial counsel referring to the most damning evidence, the request to see the attorney, or is the trial counsel referring to the entirety of the sequence of events that are then described in the trial counsel's argument?
I would say that the inference can go either way, Your Honor.
If it can go either way and there's no objection, where does that take us on a plain error argument?
If
the words could be interpreted in various ways, one permissible, one impermissible, and there's no objection, what's the consequence in terms of a plain error argument?
The consequence?
Consequence for the appellate in terms of a plain error argument. If you've got words that are used in a trial counsel's argument, and those words can be interpreted two ways, one permissible, one impermissible, and there's no objection from the defense, if we are in a plain error situation, what's the consequence of the defense not objecting when there are two interpretations, one of which is a permissible argument?
I believe the comment would have to be looked at contextually within the whole record of the trial and within the theme of both the closing argument and the theme that the trial counsel expressed throughout the trial. And the theme in this case was that he was the jack of all crimes. He was a career criminal.
Thank you.
I think Judge Efron's trying to get you to respond to how you get plain error out of a case where you can go either way. And what's your response to that? If the defense counsel doesn't object, and this may or may not be your view, but it seems to have been articulated on that you can weigh it both ways, why is it plain error to weigh it one way or the other way?
Well, Your Honor,
how can you ever get to plain error? It's a question, not a statement.
To plain error or to prejudice, Your Honor?
Plain error. Why is it obvious error if it's...
Your Honor, within the danger of the constitutional rights at issue in this case, we would submit that because of the importance of the rights at issue.
That goes to prejudice or value. Why don't you go through you're concerned about five statements, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why don't you go through each statement and perhaps tell us why it should have been obvious to the judge that this implicated constitutional rights and should have been sui sponte cut off?
Certainly, Your Honor. Officer Frazier's statement, the trial counsel was attempting to elicit that he consented, and that he failed to consent for his hair analysis, to which the witness responded that he was seeing his attorney. As stated in case law, that this cannot be used as substantive evidence of guilt. And
why in that instance isn't that a case of the officer just responding to the question to describe what occurred?
Well, it very well could have been, Your Honor. But again, we would submit that a curative instruction would be the remedy for that to offset the danger.
Okay. That doesn't make it obvious. That makes it important.
Yes, Your Honor. But there seems to be no reason that his right to attorney was mentioned, him seeing his attorney was mentioned.
Other than the officer was just describing what happened?
Certainly, Your Honor.
What happened next? He left to go see his attorney. I'm making that up.
Certainly, Your Honor. We would still submit that with that because the attorney was mentioned, and for seemingly no reason, that it raises an inference, well, not an inference, a requirement that the judge, at a minimum, give an instruction.
And is that your position on the other ones as well?
Yes, Your Honor.
What about the is it Officer 4?
Officer 4, 4A or 4, yes, Your Honor.
And isn't he a state police officer?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what impact, if any, did this occur off base, the driving thing?
Yes, Your Honor.
What impact, if any, does that have on at least the fifth statement?
Again, if seen within the context of trial counsel's theme, that he was a jack of all crimes.
Let me restate the question. Does it matter that Mississippi law provides for implied consent?
I would say no, not in this case, Your Honor.
Why not?
In regards to...
It occurred off base.
Yes, Your Honor.
He was stopped by a Mississippi officer, and under Mississippi law, the fact that he declined to take a test would be admissible.
Yes, Your Honor.
But because this is in a UCMJ context, it's not admissible, is your view, or it should have been plain error?
I believe it should have been.
I want you to answer the question.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it would have been plain error in this case, at least at a minimum, not to give a curative instruction. In this case, the government cannot prove established prejudice beyond a reasonable doubt. The charges in this case were hotly contested. Government called 6 dirty witnesses that were either convicted or disciplined pending trial. Out of the 13 specifications that he was originally charged with, he was acquitted of 6. One was withdrawn by the convening authority and one was dismissed in the action. The members were obviously influenced by the credibility problems in this case and with the circumstantial nature of the evidence. As such, the referencing of his rights likely played a, if not substantial part, a very major part in the determinations of findings.
Counsel, was the reference to the defendant's exercise of his right to counsel, was that relevant to the government's case in any way in proving their case?
I would say no, Your Honor. One area where it seems the prejudice would...
Does that mean that if the witness had answered the question, it would have been stricken as irrelevant?
Yes, sir.
So if the question was what happened and the witness said, well, he was on his way to his financial advisor, that would have been stricken?
I believe that would be admissible, Your Honor.
Well, if we're talking about relevance and not privilege, what's the difference between whether he was going to his financial advisor or going to his counsel? Don't both of them relate to the circumstances under which the events transpired between some information about a drug investigation and the shaving?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
However, we would submit that based on the theme of trial counsel's opening and closing, that a curative instruction was required. Consent in this case was a major issue. For charge 3, specification 6, appellant was charged with possession of marijuana that was found pursuant to a consent search of his room. It was uncontested that the substance seized from the appellant's residence was marijuana. The fact that the marijuana was established by the chemist, and it was indisputed at trial, and the appellant did not take the stand. What the members likely took strongly into account is that appellant consented to the search of his room. As trial defense counsel argued during the findings, now who would be consent to search a residence if they had marijuana in there and they knew they had marijuana in there? The fact that appellant consented was likely the distinguishing fact that caused the members to acquit him of the specifications of possession. A logical argument is that the inverse is true, that because he did not consent to the blood withdrawal or consent to the hair, to them retrieving hair, that they found him guilty of that offense.
Now, who was it who made the argument? Who would consent if they had marijuana in the room?
That would be trial defense counsel, Your Honor, during closing.
Trial defense counsel. If trial defense counsel has introduced into the case the issue of whether consent is probative as to guilt, why is the prosecution precluded from drawing inferences in that regard with respect to offenses that are at issue in the case?
Well, Your Honor, the trial counsel initially brought up the issue of consent, and trial defense counsel only addressed consent in regards to the search. Given the government's theme and the information elicited, references to appellant's constitutional rights occurred throughout the trial. He was referred to as the jack of all crimes in his opening argument twice. They referenced his exercise of his Fourth Amendment rights by refusing to consent to the blood withdrawal once in the opening argument. During testimony, Officer Frazier mentioned him seeing his attorney once. Officer Foray said that he refused to consent to a blood test once during direct and once during cross-examination. Special Agent Bourne, during direct, testified that he didn't consent to taking his body hair once. Two members asked in Appellate Exhibit 31 and Appellate Exhibit 32 what was the explanation for him shaving his body hair, which the military judge inquired about, and Special Agent Frazier said he invoked his rights to an attorney. In the closing arguments, he was referred to the jack of all crimes again three times. The trial counsel referred to him failing to consent to a blood test once, and he referenced him wanting to see his attorney before seizing his hair sample once, and stated that he could not seize a hair sample because he was at his attorney once. The analogy here in this case we would submit would be to Clifton and Carter. In Clifton, references were made to appellant's rights a variety of times, including the Fifth, Article 31, and the Sixth Amendment. The military judge gave the standard instruction. However, it was the gravity of the comments, of the unconscionable comments, resulted in a setting aside of the verdict. In conclusion, trial counsel, in the words of the Supreme Court, made the assertion of appellant's rights costly. And in the words of Clifton, the government may not either directly or by implication attempt to sustain or circumvent its burden of proof by capitalizing on the accused's exercise of his rights. And in this case, this is what the prosecution did. As such, we would respectfully request that this honorable court set aside the findings and sentence for charges 2, 3, and 6. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, I'm Captain Jamie Mendelson, and along with Colonel Gerald R. Bruce, I represent the United States, the appellee in this case. The single issue on appeal is whether government witnesses and the trial counsel improperly commented on appellant's exercise of his right to counsel. Appellant's claim must fail because he has not met his burden of showing plain error. And even if this court were to assume error, any error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The trial defense counsel did not object to any of the comments that appellant now complains of. Thus, this court reviews under the plain error analysis. Under the plain error test, the appellant has the burden of showing three things. First, that there was error. Second, that that error was plain or obvious. And then third, that the error materially prejudiced one of his substantial rights. If an appellant succeeds in showing plain error, then the burden shifts to the government to show that any error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Appellant in this case has failed to show error because the testimony and the comments at issue were not elicited or argued as substantive evidence of guilt. Now, this court has been clear that it is improper to elicit testimony or to argue that an accused invoked his rights as substantive evidence of guilt. And the policy behind that is clear, is to avoid the danger of the court members inferring that because somebody is using the shield of their rights, they must be guilty. But that's not what we have at play here in this case. The rule about commenting on an accused invocation or exercise of his rights is not an absolute or per se rule, because what the rule is aimed at is only those comments that are directed or focused or leading the members to an inference that this is substantive evidence of guilt. And as this court has repeatedly stated, in order to determine whether such comments are fair or whether they were improper, the comments have to be examined in the context of the trial as a whole. And in the case at hand, these comments that appellant now complains of were in one of two contexts, either in the context of the appellant's knowledge that OSI wanted a hair sample, and then his shaving off all of his body hair in order to avoid having a hair sample taken, and then in the context of the facts and circumstances, the procedures following appellant's apprehension for DUI and obtaining a blood sample for blood alcohol testing. I'll start first by focusing on the statements that were in the context of appellant shaving his body hair, and that involves the testimony of Officer Frazier, Special Agent Bourne, and then trial counsel's closing argument. Officer Frazier was a government witness. He was working with OSI, and he gave testimony about OSI's efforts to obtain a hair sample from appellant to test for drug use. Officer Frazier testified that upon obtaining search authorization, he contacted appellant's first sergeant to have the first sergeant bring appellant into OSI so that he could obtain the hair sample. That the first sergeant related to Officer Frazier that appellant was on his way to Hattiesburg to see a civilian attorney. And Officer Frazier testified that appellant didn't arrive at OSI until about 3 or 4 hours later. And when he did arrive, he had no body hair whatsoever, and a hair sample could not be taken. Now, at the conclusion of Officer Frazier's testimony, two panel members had basically the same question, which was, what was appellant's explanation for having shaved off all of his body hair? There was no objection, so the military judge asked Officer Frazier the question, along with sort of the two common sense foundational questions, which are, did you ask him, and did he give you an explanation? Officer Frazier answered appropriately that he didn't ask appellant what his explanation was, because appellant had previously requested counsel. He felt that that would be an incriminating question, and he was there solely to obtain a hair sample and not to question appellant. Special Agent Bourne testified later for the government. Special Agent Bourne also testified about OSI's efforts to obtain a hair sample, and in his testimony, he was basically going through the timing between when the appellant was first interviewed and when OSI actually was able to make an attempt to get a hair sample. The trial counsel asked Special Agent Bourne what method of authority he was using to obtain that hair sample, obviously looking for the answer that they were using search authority, because that was the method. Special Agent Bourne answered that they had first tried to get consent, but appellant didn't consent, so they then went and obtained search authorization. And he went on to testify that the search authorization was obtained about 6 days later, and then an attempt to obtain a sample wasn't made until 3 days following that. So again, it's all relating to the timing, the passage of time, and appellant's knowledge that OSI wanted a hair sample. Now, what's of note here is that on cross-examination of Special Agent Bourne, the trial defense counsel himself, in his own question, repeated that appellant had refused consent to a hair sample. And it was in the context of defense counsel was asking Special Agent Bourne if, in fact, appellant's sole knowledge of OSI wanting a hair sample could have come from when they had asked him for consent and he had refused to consent. Turning now to the trial counsel's argument, during the part of the trial counsel's argument that focused on the consciousness of guilt evidence, which, to be clear, was the shaving all of his body hair, the trial counsel in that context argued that appellant knew OSI wanted a hair sample. And what the trial counsel is referring to in that context when he says what some of the most damning evidence that you have here today is, he is clearly referring to the fact that appellant knows OSI wants a hair sample and then shows up at OSI, quote, bald as a cue ball. That is the damning evidence.
Counsel, let's take a look at that statement if we can.
Yes, Your Honor.
The trial counsel said, and I'm quoting from the record here, the OSI says, we would like to take your hair. He says, referring to the defendant, no thank you. I want to speak to my attorney first. So he knows the OSI wants his hair. Now, it seems that it's fair for the trial counsel to say, he says, no thank you, so he knows the OSI wants his hair, because that's the point he's trying to make. What is your explanation for his inclusion of that sentence, I want to speak to my attorney first, and where in the testimony is that supported? Where is it supported that when he made his initial refusal, he made it based on the fact that he wanted to speak to his attorney?
There is actually no testimony directly related to that sequence, that he was asked for hair and then he said, I want to speak to my attorney. So the governor's position is that the trial counsel is misstating a bit.
So that's an erroneous quote that the trial counsel is making at that point. I mean, it appears that he's kind of mixing up when
It does appear that what he's mixing up is then later he's on his way to Hattiesburg to see his attorney.
Okay, and so as far as the argument for inference of guilt here, what is the importance of the phrase, I want to speak to my attorney first?
Well, that's the exact point, Your Honor, that it's not important. And that's why what's important is context. And we're not just looking at the words that are in the closest proximity to what some of the most damning evidence is. We're looking at the context of that portion of trial counsel's argument. And when reading the whole portion there, what the trial counsel's saying is, what better statement of consciousness of guilt that when he goes in to speak with OSI or to give his hair sample, he's bald and shaved as a cue ball. And he points out, remember, they couldn't take hair as soon as they wanted to because he was on his way to his attorney's office in Hattiesburg.
I understand your consciousness of guilt argument. What I'm concerned about is the reference to the defendant's exercise of his right to counsel, which apparently is an erroneous statement to begin with and apparently was not necessary, but it was still given to the members.
Yes, Your Honor, but what the crux of the issue is was this a comment that was focused on an inference of guilt? Was this a comment, were the members presented with an argument that focused them on, he asked for his attorney, you know, wink, wink, he must be guilty.
Well,
that's not the focus, that's not the context of this argument.
Doesn't the question we would like you to consent to give a hair sample, and he said, no, I have to talk to my attorney first, seemed to indicate that he may be guilty of something. He has to talk to his attorney before he can do anything.
No, that's not the government's position, Your Honor. The government's position is that, if anything, that's a superfluous comment thrown in there, and it's not something that the member's attention is directed to, or it's not the focus of the argument.
That's a different point, though. Are you defending it? Are you arguing no prejudice because it's not the focus, or are you arguing it's a permissible statement? Thank you very much.
I'm sorry, but what's the, thank you very much. What is the...
Are you trying to advise the bench that you think this is an appropriate argument, or are you telling us that whether or not it's appropriate, it wasn't very important, so don't worry about it? I hear you making two arguments. What Judge Erdman's trying to focus you on is it the government's position that this is a proper argument, full stop? Then we'll talk about whether it played an important role or not.
Okay, so in response to that question, if you're asking specifically about trial counsel's statement of, no, thank you, I want to speak with my attorney first, it's not the government's position that I want to speak to my attorney first was proper in and of that particular statement, solely because that's not what the evidence showed. He was confusing the evidence a little bit and misstating what...
So the government, I'm stealing your line of questions, but all have the same line of questions. And is it improper because it was not accurate, full stop, or is it improper because it's not accurate and it was a comment on his right to have a counsel, which could be perceived as suggesting that he needed a lawyer because he was guilty?
It's the government's position that to the extent it's improper because it's not an accurate characterization of what the testimony was, what the evidence was. Addressing the fact that it was...
Is it proper for government counsel, this is a hypothetical question now, for government counsel to use a request for an attorney as evidence of innocence or guilt, to comment on it as evidence of innocence or guilt?
It is improper to comment on it as evidence of guilt.
So you would...
As substantive evidence
of
guilt.
Is this a proper argument? If he was innocent, he wouldn't have asked for a lawyer. Is that an appropriate comment?
And respectfully, you've got to look at the entire context.
Full stop, hypothetical. I'm not trying to say that's this. You'll get that chance in a second.
Understood, Your Honor.
I'm just trying to make sure.
With any specific comment, this court has been clear in all of its holdings that the comment is not looked at in isolation. It's looked at in the context of the entire trial. So that statement in and of itself.
Say there was no door opened and all that stuff. You do not want to give that up, do you? The government thinks that it's appropriate. It's too hard for the government to say that it's not appropriate for counsel to get up and say he's guilty because he wanted a lawyer. Are you saying that
the
government's not prepared to concede that?
No, the government is prepared to concede that it would be improper to stand up and argue he's guilty because he asked for an attorney after he was advised of his rights.
Fair enough. Okay, now why isn't the inference here the same? Now you get to do this case.
Yes, Your Honor. The inference here is not the same because of the context that it came up in and the context of the argument. This is not what the members are not focused
on. The focus argument, I think, goes to prejudice. Does this or does this not implicate what we just talked about?
Respectfully, Your Honor, the focus argument also goes to error because the standard isn't all comments that relate to an accused exercise of his rights are improper. The standard is comments on an accused exercise of his rights that are used as substantive evidence of guilt are improper.
And what was this comment used for? I want to speak to my attorney first.
This was used for the fact that he knows OSI wants a hair sample. And he says, no, thank you. There's a passage of time there.
Well, no. That's no thank you. What I'm asking about is I want to speak to my attorney first. What is the purpose of that in this context?
Again, it's not the government's position that this was really a statement with any purpose. Again, this was sort of a superfluous, you know, the trial counsel's kind of getting ahead of himself with his argument.
Well, I mean, the statement was made, the members are listening to it.
Yes, Your Honor.
It had some effect. What would be the effect of that?
I mean, if we're talking about the impact of this.
The impact. Talk about focus now.
There is no prejudicial impact from this comment, again, because of the context that it came up in, that the court members are not being focused on he must be guilty because he asked for his attorney. They're being focused on he knows OSI wants hair, there's a passage of time before
he knows OSI wants his hair, he's refusing because he has to talk to his attorney first, and there's a passage of time. You're forgetting that element.
Well, it's not...
That's why he's refusing. That's according to this, that's why he's refusing.
Well, I guess respectfully, the government doesn't read it that way. It didn't jump out that way.
No, thank you. I want to speak to my attorney first.
And the next sentence is, so he knows OSI wants his hair. And then 9 days later, when he comes in, he's bald as a cue ball. Again, it's that we can't just cut out one sentence from an argument and examine that in isolation or in a vacuum. It's got to be examined in the context of the argument and the trial as a whole.
So let's, if we can summarize this, is it the government's position that that's that reference to the defendant's constitutional right to invoke his right to an attorney was proper or improper?
It's the government's position that that particular reference was improper because it wasn't even based on, it was an inaccurate characterization of what the testimony was.
And for that reason only, not because, it's not the government's position that it was improper because it was a comment on his constitutional right.
It's not because we're looking, it's the government's position that it was not improper under a plain error analysis.
Okay, well, that's a different issue. What element isn't it improper under? Or what issue kicks it out of the plain error analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. It was not a plain or obvious error. And what we have that shows that is, first of all, no defense objection. And this court noted that when the defense counsel doesn't object, that is, gives some weight to the fact that this was not...
Well, it gives some weight, but it actually triggers the plain error analysis. That's why we do the plain error analysis, because there was no objection.
Yes, Your Honor. But particularly in this case, where you have extremely vigilant defense counsel who were raising 14 motions during trial, who were actively objecting throughout the trial, and in fact objecting to Officer Frazier's testimony, objecting to Special Agent Bourne's testimony, raising a motion in limine to preclude certain argument by the trial counsel right before his closing argument, objecting once during the trial counsel's argument. And we don't have potted plants as defense counsel in this case. We have extremely vigilant defense counsel, and this is not registering as improper with them. This is not registering as improper with the military judge. And we need to also look at this in the context of, or from the perspective, that those counsel sitting there and hearing the testimony, observing the witnesses and appreciating the context in a whole, they're in the best position to judge whether this is improper.
So it's not
registering with the counsel or with the military judge, and with the fact that these were highly vigilant defense counsel, that lends a lot of weight to the fact that this is not a plain or obvious error.
So that, does that put you in the error but not plain or obvious camp?
Not error with all of the comments.
No, I'm just talking about this closing argument comment.
I want to speak to my attorney first. The government will concede that comment was error, but not plain error.
Okay.
And in any event, definitely harmless beyond.
Well, time out. You got to state why you say it's error. Are you saying it's error merely because it's inaccurate or because it's inappropriate comment on the right to counsel? You're allowed to consult the bench as well if you'd like to, but you don't have to. That's your business.
I'll take one moment, Your Honor. Your Honor, it's the government's contention that it is error because it's an improper characterization of what the testimony was.
No more, no less.
No
full
more.
Stop.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, counsel, in that context, what would save the statement potentially from the argument the defense is making is that it was an accurate characterization of the transaction. Once it's no longer an accurate characterization of the transaction, why is it then not an improper comment on the right to consult with counsel?
I'm sorry.
If the transaction was that he received information about an investigation, and he went to consult with his counsel, and then he shaved his hair, and the government's offering this to show the entire course of events, then the government's argument would be that this is relevant evidence, and since it's relevant evidence, it's not plain error. However, if the government agrees that, in fact, he did not say, I want to speak to my attorney first, then it's no longer relevant evidence because it didn't happen. And if it's not relevant evidence, how does it then become a proper comment on a person's consultation with counsel?
Was not relevant because it actually was not what the testimony was. We still have no defense objection to, you know, facts not in evidence or a relevance objection. So we're still at the plain error analysis.
So the government's argument is that it was hypothetically true and therefore it wasn't a proper comment. It wasn't an improper comment, even though it wasn't true.
I think I got lost somewhere.
Let's try something else. How about the sequence, the rest of the sentence, on page 80? The trial counsel says, the OSI says, we would like to take your care. He says, no, thank you. Let's leave out the attorney bit. And then he shaves his hair. Where in the record does it show that transaction took place, where the OSI said to him, we would like to take your hair, and he said, no, thank you?
That would be from Officer Frazier and Special Agent Bourne's testimony. well, actually, specifically from Special Agent Bourne's testimony, because when the trial counsel asked him what method of authority were you using, he said that we had tried consent initially, but appellant didn't consent, so we got search authorization.
And that consent, the record is clear that that request for hair took place before he shaved his hair?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
What page of the record does Bourne testify as to that, so that we can know for sure that he was, that the appellant was told, we want your hair, and the appellant said, no, thank you, and then he went and got his hair cut?
Yes, Your Honor. It's at the record at page 772. Trial counsel first asked Special Agent Bourne, when did you first interview the appellant? And the answer was on the 20th of March. And then the next question was there a determination made to attempt to get body hair? Yes, there was. And then that's where the what method of authority question comes in. Initially, we tried consent. Was consent obtained? Or that we didn't consent, so we got search authorization. Then when was search authorization obtained? It was on the 26th of March. And then when was the sample actually?
Right. I'm aware of all that. I was trying to get to the question of, was he specific, did Bourne ever say specifically, before he got his hair cut, we asked him for his hair and he refused?
Does he say specifically before he shaved himself?
Right. I think there seems to be some dispute at trial as to whether he was asked for a hair sample before he shaved his hair.
No, Your Honor. The dispute that the defense counsel, or the point that the defense counsel was making at trial, was that there was no evidence that that appellant actually knew that his roommates and his buddies had already gone in to give a hair sample. And in fact, on cross-examination of Special Agent Bourne, the defense counsel asked the question, you know, isn't it true that appellant's first knowledge of OSI wanting a hair sample was when OSI asked for consent and he refused?
Well, it says on page 773, the question is, would he have been aware that the hair was going to be seized? Referring to, I assume, his haircut. And the defense counsel objects. Speculation. There's a lack of foundation. The military just says that's true. So it's not clear to me from pages 772 to 773 that there was an express dialogue between Bourne and the appellant prior to the appellant shaving his hair.
It is clear from the timeline of what he's testifying that there's first the interview on the 20th of March. And the clear implication from the testimony is that that's when consent was asked, on the 20th of March, following that interview. Officer Frazier had testified prior to Special Agent Bourne that was the standard procedure, that in these drug investigations, OSI would try to obtain a hair sample.
Then why did the military judge agree that there was a lack of foundation to the question of whether he would have been aware that his hair was going to be seized? It's right in the middle of page 773. Question. Would he have been aware that his hair was going to be seized? Defense counsel. Objection. Speculation. There's a lack of foundation.
Because there's a difference between him knowing that OSI wants a hair sample and him knowing that it was going to be seized being pursuant to a search authorization. The speculation there is, would he have known that the military magistrate had authorized the seizure of his hair? Okay. That's the speculation. That's the lack of the foundation. And I see that my time is out.
You may briefly conclude.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor.
We can ask some more questions about no thank you if you'd like.
No thank you. In sum, appellant has failed to meet his burden of showing plain error. And in any event, even if this court were to assume error, and I wasn't really able to get to this in my argument, but any error would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And if I may just briefly state that one of the factors that this court looks to as to whether it's harmless error is the strength of the government's case. Although appellant contends this was a hotly contested case, in fact, we have a very unique circumstance in this case because we know that those drug specifications and the DUI specification of which the appellant was convicted of, the court members announced that they found him guilty of those specifications by a unanimous finding. So this was not a hotly contested, close call.
Catalog, please, your top three evidentiary arguments as to why it was overwhelming evidence.
The number of witnesses who testified, there were six witnesses who testified about appellant's drug use, and then the fact that he shaved himself bald, that was strong evidence as well of consciousness of guilt. I just want to make sure I'm not missing anything that I had in my notes here.
So you have six witnesses and a shave. Anything else?
That would be for the drug specifications, for the DUI specification, the fact that Officer Four smelled intoxicants on his breath, that the appellant stated he was driving 25 to 30 miles per hour, that he was wearing his seatbelt.
Is Mississippi law relevant or not in this context?
I don't recall Mississippi law being part of Officer Ford's testimony. I might be mistaken.
So is that a no?
That would be a no, Your Honor. So in sum, appellant has failed to show plain error, and in any event, if this court were to assume error, any error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Your Honor, it is the defense position that trial counsel's comment on page 880 in regards to appellant seeking his attorney is plain error. As appellate government conceded, it was an error for him at least to say this because it was inaccurate. But if you look at it contextually in regards to the opening, again, the jack of all crimes theme, and the subsequent remarks within the paragraph on page 881, saying that he was trying to thwart the investigation and beat the rap, and again, referencing him seeing his attorney when they attempt to seize his hair sample. On page 81, remember they couldn't take the hair as soon as they wanted to because he was on his way to his attorney's office.
Counsel, the statement that we've talked about a lot may be inaccurate in terms of what came out of his mouth, but is it not in fact accurate in terms of what transpired?
That is,
after he said no thank you, he went to see his attorney.
Yes, sir.
And can we take that into account in assessing whether this error on the part of trial counsel was an attempt to smuggle in an improper comment on counsel?
I would think that that would not be a relevant matter before this court. His seeing his attorney is not relevant to or has minimal relevance to any issue within the case.
That wasn't my question. My question was, if in fact that's part of the transaction, can we take that into account in assessing the context of trial counsel's comments?
I believe you could, Your Honor.
Thank you.
What's your response to the government's prejudice analysis?
We would assert that prejudice in this case is apparent, or at least the government has not proven that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
The government cited the 6 witnesses, the consciousness of guilt from the shaving on the drug charges. What's your rebuttal specifically to the government's argument?
Specifically that the members found half of the charges were not credible, or at least they did not have the evidence. There was no evidence of, there was no drug seized, save the marijuana that he was found, that he was acquitted of, and charged 5, I believe, charged 3, specification 5. There was evidence that was elicited that he submitted to a urinalysis, which came back negative. So the government had 6 witnesses who had very little credibility, coupled with him shaving himself, allegedly. The prejudice also might be demonstrated through the disparity in sentence. In this case, he received 24 months at trial, a dishonorable discharge, and reduction to E1. Every other, as noted in appellant's clemency statement, no one received above 9 months or a bad conduct discharge. It is our position that this theme, this jack of all crimes, this reference to his constitutional rights carried over, as evident in the grossly disparate sentence. All the members mentioned in his clemency were convicted of distributing drugs. So was the appellant, but this charge was later dismissed by the convening authority on the action. There is absolutely no reason that appellant should receive, in some cases, 3 times the sentence combined with a dishonorable discharge than the other members that he was involved with. Based on the members' findings, based on the widely disparate sentence, and the government's concession of at least some of the comments in this, and given the fact that every reference to him failing to consent to a hair test also implicitly references his seeking an attorney. And given the nature, given the amount that this occurs in the record of a trial, we would respectfully ask this court to find prejudice and reverse the case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And we thank both counsel for your arguments today, and we will reconvene at 8 minutes after 10 o'clock. Our second case this morning is United States against Brooks, counsel for the defense.
Good morning, Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of the court. May it please the court. I'm Captain Vicki Ballou, together with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Stacey S. Brooks. I intend to argue the issues in the order that they were granted. From the beginning of the trial, trial counsel focused the members on determining AR's credibility. From voir dire through their closing argument, the government focused the members on AR's testimony and whether and why they should believe her. In voir dire, the government asked questions about whether, if it came down to the word of a young girl against the word of an adult male, would they automatically believe the adult male? And would they agree that adults are more sophisticated liars than children? That theme continued throughout their opening statements. During the opening argument, the government's first words were truth or lies, telling the members that they were there to determine whether a young girl made up the accusations and to answer the question of, did she fabricate these 3 acts and did these things actually happened. Trial counsel repeatedly informed the members that the girls' credibility would be attacked and focused them in on using the expert's testimony along with AR's testimony. Trial counsel ended their opening statement with truth or lies. We're here today because a young girl said, "Is she telling the truth?" Members, when you hear all the evidence in this case, we're confident that you will conclude that she is indeed telling the truth about these incidents. Defense's opening statement in a nutshell was telling the members to listen to AR's story that she's been telling and listen for its inconsistent statements. The military judge erred to the substantial prejudice of Staff Sergeant Brooks when he allowed the government expert to repeatedly give human lie detector testimony. It's well established that human lie detector testimony is inadmissible. Specifically, in a child sexual abuse case, an expert is not permitted to testify that the alleged victim is or is not telling the truth. U.S. v. Casper lays out three reasons why human lie detector testimony is prohibited. One, for the determination of truthfulness, it exceeds the scope of a witness's expertise, for the expert lacks specialized knowledge. Two, it violates MRE 608A because it offers an opinion as to the declarant's truthfulness on a specific occasion. And three, it places a stamp of truthfulness on a witness's story in a manner that usurps the jury's exclusive function to weigh the evidence and determine credibility. When a witness improperly gives human lie detector testimony, the military judge must act quickly to remedy the error by issuing prompt cautionary instructions to ensure that the members do not make improper use of such testimony. And in this case, the military judge was on notice that the defense objected to the government's expert testifying whether he believed AR and the reliability of AR's story because they filed a motion in limine in the very beginning to restrict the government's expert witness to not speak about the credibility of AR. The members were informed during the testimony of the government's expert witness. The members were informed of the government's expert's credentials. They were overwhelming. There were 9 pages of the record of trial take up the expert's credentials, along with the 20-page curriculum vitae that the government offered into evidence. Trial counsel continued with his credentials after the defense informed the court that they agreed he was an expert. They continued for pages more of the record of trial to make sure that the members knew how important this expert was. And also, because of their opening statement informing the members to pay attention to this expert along with his credentials, which included a presentation on truth and deception interviewing children. This is all very important when you listen to his testimony, when you put his testimony into context.
I'm going to take you offline for a second. The comment about 2-5% certainty, is that an issue of profiling or an issue of credibility?
It's both, Your Honor.
Okay, is your argument, your better argument in your view that it's profile evidence or that it's tantamount to lie detector? Which do you see it as? And if it's profile, why is it profile?
We see it as both. It may be stronger that it's clearly human lie detector testimony.
But that's not how you presented it, is it?
Correct. Okay. Well, it was presented as profile evidence for the credibility of the witness, but it's also within the argument of the profile evidence, it also states that it's human lie detector testimony.
But if it's not profile evidence, does that knock out all of your argument there, or can we still consider the underlying credibility issues?
If this court decides that it's not profile evidence, you can still consider the underlying, the human lie detector, the statements as human lie detector testimony, because that in itself is improper, along with the fact that it is it's presented to the members as profile evidence.
We've defined profile evidence in regard to accused, and in Trom specifically did not apply that theory to testimony of victims. In view of that, what's your argument that we should consider this to be profile evidence?
Because this evidence specifically goes towards the credibility of the witness, whether she's fabricated her story, that in itself goes towards the guilt or innocence of the accused. So by profiling this victim, it basically goes to the guilt or innocence of the accused, unlike giving the patterns of a sexually abused child and comparing that would not be the same as this, where it's giving a profile evidence that goes towards the credibility of the victim or the witness.
Well, how do you get around the language in Trom where the court said that testimony of the victim, and I'm paraphrasing here, did not implicate profiling because it relates to the characteristics of the child victim rather than the appellant?
Because in this case, and respectfully, in most cases, it would not be considered if it was characteristic specifically of, you know, the victim or the witness, timing as to when whether they retracted a statement or certain characteristics of them, who they tell, things of that nature. However, because this is something that goes directly towards credibility, and in turn by going towards her credibility or whether she's telling the truth or not, and that's the sole issue in this case because she's the only witness, the only eyewitness, that goes towards profile evidence.
So you're asking us to extend the profile evidence doctrine when victim's testimony involves what?
To extend it when the expert's testimony is solely focused on the credibility of the witness or the victim, of the declarant.
How's that profile the defendant?
It's profiling.
So you have a witness come in and 1,000 people, opinion people come in and say this is the most honest person they've ever known in their life. That makes them a credible witness and tell you a thing about the defendant.
Because
it may increase the likelihood the defendant committed the crime, but why does it profile the defendant?
Based on the specific statements that the victim gave or the witness gave, that because the expert is speaking to whether she's fabricating or not, that in itself is focusing on whether the defendant is guilty or innocent.
But the question here is related to the doctrine of profile evidence. Profile evidence doctrine is designed to ensure that people are not convicted because of their characteristics. Here, we're talking about the characteristics of the witness and the question of whether illustrating those characteristics turns the expert into a human lie detector and taking away the function of the jury or the panel members in deciding guilt or innocence. The testimony of the expert and the witness would appear to be the same whether the person in this case had any, the defendant in this case had any characteristics, whether they were old or middle age, whether they were officer or enlisted, whether they had come from a broken home or whether they had come from a happy home. Whatever the characteristics of the defendant in this case were, that was irrelevant to the testimony that was being given by the expert about the witness. So I don't understand how the doctrine of profile evidence, which solely deals with improperly profiling a defendant, has any pertinence to this case.
Profiled children who make false allegations in sexual assault, and it was solely on the false allegations that basically focused on.
Can you explain how that testimony does or does not turn the expert witness into a human lie detector so that the witness's testimony would take away the function of the panel members in deciding the credibility of the witness?
That testimony specifically takes away the members' function of determining the credibility of the witness because it gives the stamp of truthfulness from the expert that this it's rare for children such as the alleged victim to make false allegations. And he puts a number on it, a mathematical term. You take it away, it basically says she's telling the truth. Because she's a child, she's telling the truth.
So it's not an improper profile at that point.
It's mainly human lie detector testimony.
Which is the most alarming of the statements as far as you're concerned from the lie detector framework?
The most alarming, number one, would be obviously the one where the judge, where the expert stated that the victim's statements were credible. Now, granted, the military judge did sustain the defense's objection, but that set in the mind of the members that he found this victim, this witness, credible.
Why shouldn't we accept the defense position in that case of having their objection sustained without any further comment from the judge? Isn't there a possibility that the defense had a tactical reason for not having any further emphasis placed on the statement?
It should be because of the fact that in that particular statement, the military judge only told the members to disregard the statement. And because the military judge, when there's human lie detector testimony, should provide prompt curative instructions to inform the members how they should or should not deal with that statement, and the military judge failed to do that. All they were told was to disregard that statement. And the reason why it's important that later, why it still prejudiced the appellant is because later on, one of the members basically asked the same question and wanted an answer from the expert. Now, granted, that was sustained, but the member still was left with no idea as to why that question was improper and how he should still deal with the earlier comment from the expert that they were told to disregard.
And which of our cases would you cite for the proposition that when the defense has its objection sustained, there's a further duty upon the judge to explain further?
In Whitney and within Casper, it specifically puts the onus on the military judge to give the prompt curative instructions to ensure that the members are aware of how they should or should not deal with this human lie detector testimony.
But in both of those cases, did you have defense objections that were sustained?
In one where I believe it was Casper, where the judge did give a curative instruction.
Right, but I'm looking at the question of if the defense raises the objection and the objection is sustained, does the judge have to do more if the defense doesn't request more? Not whether the judge has a duty on the judge's own motion when the judge hears something to interject. That's a separate issue. Now I'm focusing solely on the question where the defense is alert to what's going on. The defense objects. Does the judge agrees with the defense objection? does the judge have to do more at that point? What, I understand your argument why the judge should do more, but do we have a precedent that says the judge must do more when the defense is objected and doesn't ask for any more?
I do not believe that there's a specific precedent for it. However, with CASPER, it specifically states that the military judge, whenever there's human lie detector right. testimony.
Let's be clear, though. What did the judge do in this case?
The judge specifically stated disregard. Exactly what happened was the expert said, yes, I did have several impressions. In my view, there were, despite some of the technical shortcomings of the interview, it was my impression that there were credible disclosures. I believe that. Defense counsel objected. The military judge simply stated, disregard that response.
And then in front of the members, told the doctor not to comment on credibility.
Correct.
So you have a number of things here. You have an objection, disregard members, doctor, don't talk about credibility anymore, and then you have the final closing instruction. In your view, what possibly, that's still error? I mean...
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
Well, so the one thing you were saying was missing was the complete instruction to the members at that time.
Correct. And one of the issues with the fact of the military judge instructing the witness not to speak about it, the witness specifically asked the military judge, because another question was asked by trial counsel and then objected as to leading, the expert asked the judge for instruction as to what he could talk about. So he was specifically talking to the expert, the military judge was speaking to the expert and not speaking to the members, not giving instructions to the members when he was instructing the witness.
Why is saying, or you haven't spent a lot of time, you say this is the worst statement, is it not equivalent to saying there's only a 2% chance it didn't happen? Do you understand what I'm saying? Here the witness says, I view these as credible. I guess credible is a certainty, perhaps, but 2% is pretty close to getting certain as well.
Well, because this court asked me what I found the most egregious.
Fair enough.
I would say the statements where he gives his percentages, that those are equal, well, not equally, but on the same level as egregious human lie detector testimony, giving his stamp of credibility on the credibility of the witness. And clearly his stamp, being this expert who has 20 pages worth of credentials, was impressive and impressed upon the members what his view was in regards to whether AR was telling the truth or not. And he, based on his testimony and the instances of human lie detector testimony, that he essentially told the members, took away their duty to determine credibility, and he told them, she's credible, she's telling the truth with all of his statements. To include the statements, he also talked about whether she was, one of the first instances of improper human lie detector testimony occurred when he was being questioned by the defense counsel. And the defense counsel asked him some questions in regards to whether, based on what the trial counsel had asked, not being questioned, he wasn't being questioned about AR specifically, but he was clearly questioning him in general terms that essentially that it was possible for a child to be wrong about an event, but that the child would have the expert answered that it was possible to be wrong about an event, but the child would have had to fabricate that event. And then the defense counsel asked, well, isn't it possible that it could have been suggested or ingrained through repeated interviews? And the expert responded to that, it's possible, but it seems to be somewhat unlikely outcome if we're talking about this case specifically and talking about the facts of this particular case.
And then the defense counsel immediately said, we're not talking about the facts of this case. and didn't ask for a recess or a cautionary instruction from the judge.
Correct. And
could that have been a tactical decision not to bring the jury's, call the jury's attention to this matter? Because later he did object to testimony that bordered on or dealt with credibility.
Obviously, it possibly could have been a tactical decision, but the problem is it was, the onus is on the military judge to get rid of this clearly improper human lie detector testimony. The military judge should have provided a curative instruction. And if not at this point, he was most definitely on notice that human lie detector testimony was coming in on the 3 to 4 other occasions that the expert testified to, the 3 or 4 other human lie detector testimony that the expert gave. So,
in the situation we were just discussing, why isn't it the responsibility of the defense counsel to preface the question by making it clear from the defense counsel's perspective that their defense counsel is asking a hypothetical question? Once the defense counsel is asked the question about what do you think, and the witness answers, and isn't it a little late for the defense counsel to say, "Oh, we're not talking about this case"?
Sir, if that was what exactly happened, that would be, yes, a problem. However, in this case, when you take it into context, the questions that were being asked, it's clear that these were hypothetical, and it's clear specifically based on what the witness states. Because prior to that question, he asked, basically, or states, but we are talking now very hypothetically in a very general way. And then following that comes the next two questions. So the witness clearly...
Why wouldn't the witness understand that last question that was asked to refer to the specific case? I can understand how the context may have generated, in retrospect, a view that this was about a hypothetical situation. But in those circumstances, you're sitting there at trial, you're looking at the witness, you know that you're looking at the accused, you know about the witness. Why isn't the witness then in a situation where the witness may think that they're being asked about this particular case?
Because of the basically the flow of the question and the flow of his answers, it's clear that he knew that this was general terms. He said possible, but under the factors of this case. So it's clear based on that and based on the timing and the way the questions all interrelated with them, each one was related to the other, there's no doubt that he did not know whether the defense counsel was speaking about AR or speaking in general terms. He knew that the defense counsel was speaking about generalities, not specifically in regards to AR.
On the member selection question, does the record reflect what categories of potential members were excluded from the pool that went to the CA? And does the record reflect, with respect to those categories, what in fact we're talking about? So, for example, does the record reflect that the staff judge advocate excluded officers in the accused unit?
Within the pretrial advice, it specifically tells the, it states at tab 2 is a listing of officers assigned. You may select any of these. Additionally, I have eliminated officers who would most likely be challenged for cause, those specific officers, JAGs, chaplains, IGs, or officers in the accused unit.
Okay, and what was the accused unit? Do we know how many officers were potentially excluded? Was his unit a 5-man special forces team, or was his unit the entire wing?
We do not know what was classified as his unit. It's not within the record as to who specifically was eliminated. However, the way that the SJA, or the way the evidence that the committee authority had in front of them was an alpha roster, and that was these individuals were likely eliminated from that alpha roster, but it's not.
And an alpha roster is what?
It's the roster of the entire base. So it would be the roster of everyone within the base.
And what was this person's unit? That's surely in the record, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor. It is.
What's the answer?
I don't know the answer off the top of my head. I see that my time is up. I can give that within rebuttal.
One last question I'd like to follow up on that regard, and that is the pretrial advice. Would we be correct in assuming that the pretrial advice was available to the defense counsel prior to the court-martial being convened?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, defense, for your argument. You'll have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Please, the court. Good morning. My name is Major Kimani Eason. I, along with Colonel Gerald Bruce, represent the United States in this matter. In answer to Judge Baker's last question, it was the 352nd Information Operations Squadron at Hickam Air Force Base.
And do you happen to know, does the record reflect how many officers we're talking about?
No, Your Honor.
Counsel, as long as we're starting with that, and before we get into the discussions on human lie detector and profile evidence, Article 25C1 provides an exclusion for enlisted members of the same unit. It provides for no other exclusions, categorical exclusions. Why then is it not error for this SJA to have categorically excluded all of these different categories of officers?
I can't say, officers in particular in his unit, I can't say that it was not error. However, I can say that it was not an improper motive for the SJA to exclude those particular officers. The rationale wasn't to achieve a desired result. It was to promote efficiency by eliminating potential challenges for cause. So to the extent that it was error, it wasn't the malicious type error that you find in
So the government concedes that the exclusions were error, but they were not motivated by any wrongful purpose.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But if there's error in the selection of the members, that's pretty fundamental. That's the threshold event in a member's trial.
I'm sorry.
Well,
I didn't hear what you said.
Oh, I'm. If it's error, if the members were selected improperly or in error, not with improper motive, just in error, why isn't that a threshold and fundamental error that puts the whole court-martial in question?
Let me backtrack on that. And it's not the United States' position that this was error. I guess the better statement would have been to say that if this honorable court believes that it was error, this error wasn't done by an improper motive. But it's not the position of the United States that this is error. I hope that answers.
It answers the question.
Well, let's follow up on that a little bit. Let's just, for purposes of this discussion, assume that it was error. In following up on Judge Baker's question, why then does the motivation of the SJA enter into the equation if the accused was not given the opportunity to have a panel that, absent the error, other members would have had, or other accused would have had?
It's kind of a vague question because you're assuming that other accused in this particular base.
Well, if we're assuming that it's error to make these exclusions, then in a properly run court martial, the exclusions wouldn't be there, and an accused would have the ability to have a potential panel from all aspects of the base. You may want a JAG, you may want a chaplain, you may want an OSI person. I mean, as a defendant, you know, depending on what your case is, those people you may think would be good members. And here the SJA is making the challenge decision essentially on behalf of the appellant and saying, we're not even going to let him get there.
Your I think the best way of handling it, I think the best way to answer that question as far as the rationale of the SJA would be to say that, okay, it's true, a defendant may want a JAG and a defendant may want an IG, but in most instances, they're not going to want that. And so to include a JAG or an IG or a person who who's a member of his unit, an officer who's a member of his unit, it would create the appearance that that this is a hand-picked court by the convening authority. And to alleviate that appearance, the SJA recommended to the convening authority, you know, or excluded, to, well, recommended that JAGs, IGs, people in the squadron should be eliminated.
But what if the defense came in and objected and said, I want the JAGs and the IGs. This is, if in a particular case, and said, this is a case about honesty and integrity, and my honesty and integrity has been impugned, and I want the people who understand they are the best qualified in the case. And here the convening authority has just, without even looking individually at anybody, knocked them out. Why wouldn't that be error?
I don't think the record is clear that the convening authority has knocked him out. I think the convening authority, when he was presented with the pretrial advice, along with the members on the base, I'm not quite sure what the SJA meant by I have eliminated all those JAGs, IGs. I don't know if, in that sense, he's recommending that the convening authority eliminate them, because the convening authority is free to say, no, I want to consider those individuals.
Were they on the list that were presented to him?
I do not know.
So we don't even know what the record stands for in this case? Government can't tell us? We've litigated this case now through the Court of Appeals and here, and we don't know whether the JAGs and the IGs were in fact on that list before the convening authority? Wouldn't it be fair to presume at this stage, since it hasn't been shown otherwise, that the SJA's words mean what they said? They're eliminated, they're not on the list?
It would be fair to presume that.
Okay. So we've got, they're not on the list. What do we do? We're going to have to write about not just this case, but write a general principle of law here. What's the proposition that we should deal with when the defense objects and says, you have eliminated whole classes of people who can fall within Article 25 criteria being best qualified? Who would be better qualified in a case involving accountability and integrity than JAGs, IGs, MPs? And if the judge says, forget it, the convening authority eliminated these people, and I'm going to sustain the convening authority's action. Now we're on appeal.
That did not happen in this case.
I understand it didn't happen in this case. But is it the government's position that it didn't happen? This goes back to the question that Judge Urban asked before. Is this error in this case, in which the government's arguing that the error is harmless because there's no defense objection? Or is there no error in this case because the government would like us to write an opinion that says this is perfectly fine? Anytime a convening authority wants to knock out the JAGs, the IGs, and the MPs, the convening authority can do that across the board. Is that the JAGs, the IGs, the MPs, across the board? Is that what the government wants us to write an opinion in this case?
No, Your Honor, that's not what the government wishes. There are no further questions on that particular issue. I'll turn to.
How do we test for prejudice on that issue?
Well, first of all, I mean, the appellant must show that the proceedings were unfair based on the exclusion of these particular members, and that the exclusion was the cause of the unfairness in the proceedings. That's, I think, how this honorable court should test for prejudice, and neither of which he's shown.
So you're out of luck if the members are improperly selected for the sake of argument. So long as it was still a fair trial, no problem.
If the members were improperly selected.
Let's say with no improper motive, but for military reasons of military readiness, all the members, the CA said, I only want people selected out of this one unit. And the government stipulates Article 25 criteria were not applied. But when the day was done, it was a fair trial. That's tough luck to the appellant. Didn't get the trial, didn't get the member pool to question and do all that, but too bad, it's a fair trial.
I think the appellant, if they have a problem with the selection of the members, could make a motion or make an objection to that. However, if it is a fair trial, then it is a fair trial. And
so your response is the response, then that's why you object at the beginning. Now, and we're testing from the back end rather than the front end.
Yes.
Is that, you tell me, but is that your view?
I think that my view or the government's view is that if the appellant has a problem with the selection of the members, the appellant should make an objection to that. And absent the objection, it's presumed that he does not have a problem with the selection of the members. And if it's a fair trial, as Your Honor said, then it's a fair trial and there's no harm.
Counsel, turning to the human lie detector question. Perhaps you could describe to us what a lie detector is. I'll offer a very simplistic overview, and that is it's a process by which people who demonstrate particular characteristics are determined to show a lack of veracity. And that can be done through a mechanical means of showing, for example, certain changes in heartbeat, blood pressure, sometimes brain waves. My understanding of what a lie detector does is that it's not 100%, that it's based on probabilities, that it's well known that the lie detector can be defeated, and so that when someone takes a polygraph, for example, the polygraph examiner will not be able to say this person is lying because they don't know, since they know that it doesn't catch 100%, they say deception indicated. That kind of testimony is not allowed in a court martial, not allowed in most courts of law. Here, when we're talking about the testimony as to the percentages, the testimony on record at 250 to 252, why is that not lie detector testimony? When the person gets up and says, people who have these characteristics tell the truth in what they're saying 95%, 98% of the time. Why isn't that accomplishing the same as the prohibited testimony of someone who says people who have a different set of characteristics, that is, brain waves, heartbeat, are lying?
Of course, the court in Powell has stated that that is a form of human lie detector testimony. The government acknowledges that. The United States does not believe that it is human lie detector testimony because there are those percentage cases, the 2 to 5% cases, for example, of false sex abuse allegations that supposedly are true or are not true. So there's a possibility that remains. The expert has not testified that the person is telling the truth.
But that's the same if a person testifies on a polygraph. A polygraph examiner, who's a qualified expert who understands his or her field, won't get on the stand and say, this person is telling the truth. They'll describe the test that was administered, show the results on the graph, and then say deception was indicated. And then if the defense counsel says, does that mean that the person was lying, the polygraph examiner will say, I don't know.
Right.
All I can tell you is that deception was or was not indicated. That testimony isn't permitted.
And again, I mean, again, just citing the Powell case, the government does concede that that should not have been permitted into evidence, as because it is human lie detector testimony. Now, to the extent that this honorable court does believe that it is human lie detector testimony, I want to distinguish briefly Powell and this case. In Powell, the court gave an instruction regarding the general credibility of witnesses, but did not give an instruction regarding expert testimony. In our particular case, the judge did give an instruction on expert testimony. So the court in Powell had no way of considering how to use, if at all, that testimony that it's a 99% chance, if you will, that the person is telling the truth. They had no way of knowing how to use that testimony. So without the military judge's instructions, in essence, the appellant's credibility as well as the victim's credibility was taken out of the member's hands and placed in the expert's hands.
Well, what instructions would be given? As I understand your argument, it's that polygraphs are prohibited, but an expert who would testify as to the same percentages based upon a non-polygraph standard could testify as long as some kind of instruction was given.
I don't want to say that they could testify, because under Powell it is error for the judge, for the expert to testify to that. However, the error must substantially prejudice the appellant. And I think the instructions that the judge could give is the one that he gave, and that is, to the extent that you believe that Dr. A testified or implied that he believed the alleged victim, which is what that testimony goes to, or that a crime occurred, or that the alleged victim is credible, you may not consider this as evidence that a crime occurred or that the alleged victim is credible. So what the military judge gave in his findings instructions cured whatever error that was associated with that testimony.
So at least with respect to 250 and 252, your argument is error but harmless?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Are there any other of the statements in which you would say that was error but harmless, or all the others not error in your view?
First statement that the appellant complains of regarding Dr. A responding by saying that it was possible, but it was somewhat unlikely outcome if you're talking about the facts in this case. The government's position is that we don't believe it's error. However, again, to the extent this honorable court does find error in that statement, it too, in fact, all the statements were cured by the military judge's instructions. The third statement regarding the second statement deals with the credible disclosures. The third statement that was objected to and sustained, the third statement that AR was a normal 5-year-old who did not have a psychopathological condition that would influence her tendency to confabulate, is proper expert testimony. Did not go to the credibility of AR, but it was based on the expert's assessment of AR. He had opportunity of doing various tests with her, as well as his views from the videotape interview she did with OSI. So that's basically a psychological assessment that she did not have a pathological condition or a mental health deficiency of some sort. The third statement that AR's allegations did not appear to be coached or rehearsed I think this honorable court stated in Casey that this was not human lie detector testimony, and that it was proper for an expert to discern whether a victim appears to be rehearsed, coached, or is feigning. So to the extent that that first statement dealing with is a somewhat unlikely outcome, but it's possible that she's fabricating the event, to the extent that, that's the only one that would raise the inference of a potential error, but we do not believe that it is error.
Thank you.
Can a curative instruction cure all harms? That's probably too abstract, but what should we look in the, how do we know if a curative instruction cures a harm? Let's say the person gets up and says, he's guilty, I know he is, as sure as I am of anything I've ever been sure of, he's guilty. Can that be cured?
It's possible that it cannot.
In what criteria should we apply to trying to determine whether a curative instruction in fact cures? Give me some parameters. How quickly it's given? Do you poll the individual members to make sure they understand? What are some of the things we should look at, if anything, to try and figure out when a curative instruction cures?
I think it would be based on the error that has come out in trial. Applying it to this particular case, I think the instruction given by the military judge regarding expert testimony cured all or any potential error of human lie detector testimony that may have been admitted into evidence. And he did it on at least three different occasions. Frequency is not necessary, like frequency of the instructions or the number of instructions. I think it solely goes based on the error that has been presented at court. It's hard to answer that question in the abstract, but that's the best that I can give you. So we've talked about issues one, two. Issue number three, trial counsel's use of the term "we are confident," or "we are convinced," was not plain error in this sense.
Was it error?
No, I do not believe so. And the reason being, or the government's position is that we do not believe so. And the reason being is because counsel is just saying United States believes when he says we. He did not put his personal commentary, if you will, on whatever he was trying to advocate. It was a position of the government as the prosecutor.
Well, is it any worse for a prosecutor to argue that the United States thinks this witness is credible rather than him saying, I think this witness is credible, giving the full weight and force of the authority of the United States behind that?
That argument should not be made. But you have to look at it throughout the entire argument. Trial counsel's argument was...
Well, I agree that looking at this in the entire context, I think the closing was something like 26 pages with rebuttal.
32 pages.
32 pages. But we still have these comments. So I think that we look at the comments to see if they're error, and then we look at the context to see if it was plain or obvious. Or do we look at the entire context to determine whether it was error to begin with?
Well, I think that you should look at it throughout the entire context to make a determination if it was error. And because it wasn't objected to, if it was plain error, then go through the steps of was it error, one, two, was it plain or obvious, and three, did it substantially affect the appellant's rights. To the extent that it was error, if at all, it certainly didn't prejudice the appellant's rights. So you can't find, at least the United States, at least we believe that you can't find plain error in that particular, those particular statements. So,
so if it was error, it was harmless.
Yes, yes, Your Honor. And finally, to the extent that there was error in the first four issues, if you will, taken cumulatively, these errors were harmless. You have AR's testimony that the appellant pulled down her pants, that he showed her his wiener. But more importantly, you have the appellant's comments to his commander, which assert that AR came into the restroom, saw him urinate, asked to see his quote-unquote pee-pee, and he scolded her. And this was her way of getting back at him. And so you're presuming that a 5-6-year-old child would have a social maturity, at least the appellant is presuming that a 5-6-year-old child has a social maturity to make such a serious allegation to get back at him. And that just doesn't make sense. And the second thing that you have is appellant's statement to his commander that at all times, originally at all times, AR rode in the back seat of his car. And when his commander expressed some concern about that statement to say, well, if that's true, then how could you play this tickling or this hand puppet game and tickle her? Appellant didn't say anything, and then hours later came back and said, oh yeah, there's this one time. So that gives the appellant opportunity to have shown his quote wiener to AR. So this the findings of guilty based on the evidence in context or the totality of the evidence should be affirmed. There are no further questions. That concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal from the defense.
In regards to the trial counsel's improper argument, it was improper argument. And looking at the entire argument, it's clear that the trial counsel put the government's weight behind the credibility of AR. Trial counsel's findings argument began with the same theme of the opening statement and the theme throughout the trial, truth or lies. And AR is telling the truth. Trial counsel repeated throughout the closing argument that AR was telling the truth. And to support, when going through, trial counsel says, AR's testimony is corroborated by other witnesses. He states after each example that he gives, we know that's true. So he says over four times, we know that's true. And then during his initial closing argument, and then during rebuttal, trial counsel once again reminds the members that AR is not making false allegations, and he ends his findings argument, which is entirely laden with comments on truth or lies, and AR is telling the truth. He ends the argument rebuttal with, we are convinced, and we hope that you are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that AR, when she testified in this courtroom, told the truth when she told the story. When she told her allegations to you. He takes it one step further and tells them to consider her testimony along with the government's expert's testimony. And with their testimony tied together, he states, we are confident that you will believe that 7-year-old child, that she is not making this up, she's not confused, she doesn't like attention, she's telling the truth. Trial counsel impermissibly expressed his opinion that AR was telling the truth in his findings, argument, and rebuttal. He went that one step further than just expressing his opinion that AR was telling the truth, but he also informed the members to the degree that he was convinced that AR was telling the truth. He stated, "We are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt." This error was...
Counsel, I'm not sure you can draw that out of the statement. He said, "We are convinced, comma, and we hope that you are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt." Isn't he expressing there the standard that the members have to follow?
Yes, but because it's within the same sentence, it's clear that he's stating that he's convinced, we are convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. So this improper argument, this error was plain and obvious. It's well established that counsel cannot express their personal belief or opinion in the truth or falsity of any testimony or evidence during closing argument. Because he stated it at least five times where he informed the members that we are convinced or we know it's true, appellant's substantial rights were violated and he were prejudiced. He put the weight of the government and also the weight of the expert behind AR's testimony, the expert who gave repeated human lie detector testimony throughout his own testimony behind AR, the one eyewitness in the whole, basically the person that the government's weight was on.
Possible, in regard to the selection of the members, does it make any difference whether there was or was not an improper motive on the part of the staff judge advocate in making this exclusion, and why not?
Because it was a systematic exclusion of a group of people, and based on that, just by the appearance, it gives the appearance of unfair, and basically it doesn't give the appearance of a fair trial for the appellant.
So, counsel, is it the responsibility of defense counsel to review the pretrial advice before case proceeds?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. There's no allegation of ineffective assistance of counsel here.
There was, Your Honor.
In that particular respect?
I'm not sure.
No, was there an allegation that defense counsel was ineffective by failing to review the pretrial advice?
I don't believe so.
Don't think so either. So why don't we proceed on the presumption that the defense counsel looked at that and said, "That's great, I don't want them either"?
Because this error, because of the way that the staff judge advocate did it, that it gives the appearance of, it's inappropriate to uphold this. It's inappropriate because it gives the appearance that there isn't a fair and impartial military justice system. So
I think we understand your argument in that regard.
Pardon?
I think we understand your argument in that regard.
I see that my time is up. May I conclude?
Yes.
When you take all of these errors, one, all the human lie detector testimony throughout the entire testimony of the expert, each one affected the rights and prejudiced the appellant. When you take them all together, if this court does not find that each one separately is prejudicial, but together they are prejudicial. And when you take all the errors that occurred within this trial together, cumulative error doctrine applies also if the court does not find that the other errors by themselves should not grant reversal based on that, but all of them together, the cumulative error doctrine would apply. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our arguments for this morning. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. We welcome our visitors from the National Youth Leadership Forum, and after the court recess, in about 3 or 4 minutes, there will be an opportunity for an informal question and answer session.